We welcome you here this evening for the final presentation of Dr. Ralph Underweger and the Wenchel Lectures for the 1972-73 school year. And as he promised this afternoon, this evening he will concentrate on the persons to whom the message is addressed. And he teasingly indicated this afternoon that there were four types of persons who were given very interesting biblical kind of designations that are the addressees of the communication which they found in their research. So, we'll turn it over to Dr. Underweger at this point.
Thank you, sir. In preaching, the message is directed to a congregation. There are people before you. What kind of people? Who are they? What are their fears, their anxieties, their dreams, their visions, their hopes, their commitment, their beliefs? From our information, it's very clear that on any given Sunday, you must look at the group of people before you and understand the great diversity, the broad band of variety that exists. They're not all the same type, and they will not all be hearing the same thing, even though they're hearing the same word. Part of your problem as a preacher, as a communicator of the gospel, will be to find ways to deal with that diversity. In our book, we reported the major finding that Lutherans vary along the law-gospel polarity. Since the completion of the book, we've gone further in terms of data analysis and have put together a way of looking at persons who are low and high on the major dimensions of law and gospel. So we have four groups: persons who are low on both, persons who are low on one or high on the other, and that gives you two groups, and persons who are high on both. We find some extremely interesting differences between these groups. I've given them names of biblical characters that I feel express the dynamics, again, what my understanding would be as a clinician and a person with some sense of the psychology of religion, as to what's likely to be going on and how it's possible to get these four different typologies. The first is Ishmael. Consider the life of Ishmael. From birth till about age 14 to 16, he was the inheritor of the promise. He would live comfortably in the certainty that the promise, the inheritance of his father Abraham, was to be seated. Also, undoubtedly aware of the promise of the birth of the Messiah, if we can think of it in those clear terms, but the promise that all nations would be blessed in his seed. That was all part of his consciousness and awareness. And as near as the biblical record can indicate, Abraham was quite fond of Ishmael. But then suddenly, with the birth of Isaac, that's all gone. The promise is removed. The inheritance is no longer his. And at the time of the weaning, when Ishmael inadvertently smarts off a little bit, make some problems, Sarah arranges it, if you will, that Ishmael is kicked out of the camp together with his mother Hagar. And there's really not much more poignant scene in scripture than Hagar and her son Ishmael being thrown out of Abraham's camp to walk in the wilderness. And again, it would seem from what little we know of Ishmael's later life that the prophecy about him, that he was a wild man whose hand was sent against every man and against whom every man's hand was set, turned out to be the case. Though he became an archer and a hunter and the progenitor of a great nation, it appears that he had considerable anger, hostility, resentment, unhappiness, and bitterness in his life. And we have a group of persons who bear a very close resemblance to that type of life in the study of generations data. Persons whom it appears for a considerable length of time believed and trusted in the law as the way to live. Believed that, yes, to be related to God is to live by the law. Who believed that this would bring the inheritance of the promise, but have discovered that it does not work. That the inheritance, the promise, the good life, the abundant life, the life of joy, is not discovered, is not found through living by the law. And like Ishmael, then leave the camp. Abandon the promise, not the law, not the rule, that's kept, that's maintained. But who abandon the promise, who turn away from, let's say, the doctrine, and who find themselves in enmity and hostility toward all men around them. This would be the group that is high in terms of law orientation, very low in terms of gospel orientation. They're angry people, and they're hurting people. For it's this group that shows the highest level of prejudice, of hostility, suspiciousness, fear. Out of this group of persons, 40% of them will say, I think often of suicide. 40% will say, I am a very suspicious person. Now that takes a lot of guts to take an item like, I am a very suspicious person, answer yes or no, and answer yes. I am very suspicious. A high proportion of this group will say things like, I do not enjoy little children. Who in his right mind is going to say, I don't like little kids? But the Ishmaelites do. More than any other group, they report no friends, zero friends. And again, particularly on all the measures of being alienated, feeling my ideas are out of date, nobody is friendly around here, nobody pays attention to me. The world is a terrible place. It's filled with danger. The first thing I think of in the morning when I wake up is all the dangers in the world. And it goes on and on and on like that. In terms of doctrine, this group rejects all of the historic Christian doctrine, the virgin birth, the resurrection, the vicarious atonement, the doctrine of the Eucharist, that Christ's body and blood are present. They reject any sense of God as personally involved in their lives, as caring for them. Rather, God is perceived as far away, distant, remote, judging, punitive, hostile towards them, punishing them for specific sins. The world is simply hell, what it boils down to. You can go throughout all of the 740 items, and wherever you would find any kind of item expressing that kind of alienation, that kind of fear, that kind of hostility, truly, every man's hand is set against them, and their hand is against every other man. And that would be true of those persons whom I choose to call, as a typology, Ishmael. The second group, I choose to give the name Solomon. In some ways, Solomon comes off pretty well for Christians, but I'm struck by, and I'm sure many of you are too, by the discrepancy between the popular picture that most of us have of Solomon as a very wise man, a competent ruler, and the comment made to Rehoboam following Solomon's death to the effect, "Look, Rehoboam, your father was really very, very hard on us. Please do not treat us like he did. Take the heavy yoke away from us that he put on us." And the fact that the temple was built with slave labor, and the 700 wives and 300 concubines, and the conduct of pagan worship in high places, along with the impressive wisdom that appears to have been a part of Solomon's life. But what is that wisdom? How wise is it indeed? Or is it simply the conventional wisdom of Solomon's day? One thing that seems to me, both in terms of his wives and concubines, his use of slave labor, his heavy taxation, his building of the defenses of the kingdom, and the fact that the kingdom fractured afterwards from inside, I perceive Solomon as having a fundamental view that people are replaceable. You can replace one person with another. In our information, in our data, the group that is low on law, that is the more obvious, crass kinds of law statements, and also low on the gospel, are the ones whom I choose to call Solomon. For here is the expression of all of the conventional wisdom of the time, of the age. Apparent endorsement of all the open, free, accepting attitudes toward other persons, toward various groups, heavy commitment, apparently, to the rhetoric of social involvement, the really contemporary with it kind of person, low on measures of prejudice, the obvious measures of prejudice, low in terms of any hostility towards other people, overtly expressed, high in terms of acceptance of change, willingness to accept new things, not threatened by change, lots of openness to the world, as with Solomon, lots of sensuality. Here too, the group, as with the Ishmaelites, tends to be very much rejecting of any historic or traditional or orthodox Christian doctrine, to espouse much more clearly a liberal, a scientific humanism, to say things like, Jesus never really existed. And if he did, he was just a man, and it has no significance beyond the possibility of serving as a moral kind of model, sort of an ideal kind of person. Or to say things that the church as it is now constituted is entirely out of date, it needs complete revamping, It's not just we need new denominations or new alignments, but we need whole new institutions for the church. That the church must change, and that's the most important thing about the church. And so on. However, there are at least some significant traces in our data for understanding that, like the early Solomon, there is a basic attitude here too that people are replaceable. For this is the group that tends to also have the highest level of reported sexual contact outside of marriage, whether they're married or not married, to, let's say, be quite willing to espouse views toward sexual behavior that would keep sex the constant while the people change. To emphasize in this area technique, to think, yeah, that's where it's at. Also, some rather subtle kinds of things about social issues. For again, we have a very interesting scale. We call it power orientation to social issues that contains the rhetoric of openness and involvement, but also contains the element that, yes, social issues are the most important thing in the world today, and they're going to be solved by those who have the power. That what makes the difference is who has the power. And on this one dimension, out of all of them, when we use the multivariate analytic procedures that I've mentioned very briefly, very complex, sophisticated kinds of measures that give us an ability to get some kind of causal information, we found this very curious thing, that there are two diametrically opposed groups on everything else in all of our studies who agree on this dimension, that when it comes to social issues, it's power that makes the difference, and the kind of power that grows out of the barrel of a gun. And those are the Solomon type and the Ishmael type. The only difference between them is that the one is very open to change, and the other very closed to change. And they agree that social issues are going to be solved by who has the greatest power. We comment, there are the seeds of civil war. That's where it begins. And here too, viewing social issues as basically settled by power would somehow need to include within it, it seems to me, again, the basic conviction people are replaceable. Like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who could stand before the French populace of Paris and declaim, it exists, friends, countrymen, that burning passion, that flaming zeal, that glowing, fiery love for mankind, it exists, citizens. And 2 feet away, the guillotine was going snick, 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 snick. That's the Solomon typology. Not likely most often to be in church too much, but there will be some. Incidentally, I should add that while it would appear this might be more characteristic of youth than of any other group, when we did a multivariate analysis comparing age simultaneously with the effects of the various combinations of levels in law and gospel, they are independent. There's no interaction. The Solomon group, the Solomon typology, is not going to be limited strictly to young people. It exists across all age brackets and is not directly affected by age. The third typology is what I've chosen to call the elder brother, those who are high on both law and gospel. This is, in a sense, the most numerous within the Lutheran population of the four groups. it's evident that out of all four groups, this is the happiest, the most stable, the most secure. They report the least amount of trouble with their families, the greatest or highest levels of satisfaction. They express very beautifully all of the historic or traditional dogmas or doctrines of the church. You know, they're very strongly committed to it. They lack any expression of doubt or fear or anxiety about those doctrines. They're very, very positive. But have difficulty understanding the concept of grace and what forgiveness means, would still be maintaining, along with saying that Jesus is my personal Savior, that salvation depends upon doing good works. And yet again, this combination, that the words are there, the language is there, but somehow the message is not in full shape. That is the message of the gospel. Like the elder brother, they're very faithful. This is a group that has the highest proportion of people serving on church offices, church board, teaching Sunday school, being very regular, faithful contributors, people who are in church almost every Sunday. It's also the group in the church most likely to show hostility and prejudice, almost to the level of the Ishmael type. Most likely to express some pretty harsh and judgmental concerns about other persons. And I think from this you can sense why the name elder brother seems most appropriate. All kinds of neat things going on. Lots of stability, hardworking, industrious, thrifty, prudent, making the right confession. But when the presentation of grace is evident, how come you never killed a fatted calf for me? Why didn't you do that? Now, here I've served you all these years, and I never got that kind of love. Fourth and final group, that which I have chosen to call by the name Abraham, would be the typology or the group of persons that is low in terms of law, dimensions of law, and high in terms of dimension of the gospel. And I find it difficult to refrain from saying, as I look at all the information across all items and see how this group performs, I find it very difficult to refrain from saying, these are beautiful people. Like Abraham, they're not tied to structures. They're not bound to any kind of external security. They're open to change, open to the world, express all kinds of compassion and concern, like the Solomon type. They're very much with it. You could not fault them in terms of any kind of openness toward the world, toward other persons, toward caring and compassionate behavior. Right there. Like Abraham, too, however, they maintain an extremely devout and pious relationship to God that has almost a private quality to it. They're not afraid to be in a strange place, an alien country, because they have a sense that God walks with them. And so there's, for this group, a much higher emphasis upon, let's say, private, devotional kinds of activities. Simple things like reading the Bible, spending time alone in prayer. Out of the Lutheran population, those persons who tend to do that kind of thing almost exclusively are limited to the group that I'm calling Abraham type. They can clearly distinguish between the demand of the law and the promise of the gospel. There's no problems here. They understand that distinction. They are not antinomian. They do not reject the law. They're not against morality in any sense. But they do not allow the accusation to destroy them. They trust and have confidence in the forgiveness and mercy that they know and believe in Christ. In terms of the historic Christian dogmas or doctrines, they would be expressive with the elder brother type. Commitment to a very conservative, if you will, orthodox Christian faith in terms of the ecumenical creeds and the historical realities. They're possibly even stronger, or it's more characteristic of this group, to have a sense of the personal, caring, loving, healing presence of God in their lives than any other group, including particularly the elder brother, who would say the right thing about God's presence in his life, but the emotional experience of it is not present. Here God is perceived and felt to be closely involved, imminently involved in their lives. A strong sense that, yes, God is there. He comes to me through other people, through the word and sacrament, and I depend upon, rely upon that kind of relationship with God. This is a brief sketch of the four typologies. There are many other kinds of things that could be said. For example, when I talked about the Ishmaelites and the anger involved, if you bear in mind what Romans 1 says regarding those who change the truth of God into a lie and worship and serve the creature more than the Creator, and the end result of that is that God gives them over to their own lust, including homosexuality. We did ask people to report on their sexual behavior during the past year. We did get persons who said, a little bit less than 1% of the population, during the last year, I have had homosexual intercourse. Almost everybody in that group, that is those who reported I've had homosexual intercourse within the past year, would be in the Ishmael group. Almost exactly what you would predict on the basis of Romans 1 and its statements about the way in which God gives people over to their own lust. There are other kinds of things that also become apparent. The behavior that people report. We asked them again to give us information on what they had done in the past year and lots of different kinds of things. And by the methods we used, we got two different scales of, let's call it sort of good deeds, personal agape kinds of things are what we originally called them. People who would send cards to people in the hospital, visit somebody in jail, sit up with somebody after a bad drug trip, take people for grocery shopping when they couldn't get there, take casseroles, help people in assignments, help neighbors or help people along the street, help people that had flat tires, and a whole bunch of things of that nature. And they broke up into two separate dimensions, one of which we labeled good neighbor type deeds, because those kinds of behaviors tend to occur within a neighborhood setting where there are interpersonal relationships of some, you'd expect, long-lasting duration. And what we term good Samaritan behaviors, that is, behaviors of a helping kind that tended to occur in very casual settings, that is, swift or sporadic meetings, like the person on the highway that has a flat tire, or the policeman's family, and the policeman's been shot and killed, and you send money to a special fund. That's somewhat of an impersonal kind of behavior. It's helping, but it's not within the framework of a personal relationship as strong. Elder brother type, tend to be quite high on Good Samaritan kinds of behaviors. That is, behaviors that are not within the framework of a personal relationship, as do, strangely enough, Ishmael types. So I like to help, and you do helping things, but not as strongly or readily when there is some length or duration of time involved. Abraham types, on the other hand, are more likely to report behaviors of the good neighbor kind that are within the framework of a personal relationship, as well as Good Samaritan type behaviors that are casual, fleeting, transitory in nature. How would you explain that? How would you understand that? What would cause that? Those are the observed data, the way it works out. Now, how do you make sense out of it, and what does it mean to you? If we are able to, we will attempt to draw a more, a more complete and cohesive picture of these four typologies. There are very significant differences that exist, only a few of which I've been able to mention. These are likely to be the kinds of people that you will have in your congregation on any given Sunday. Now, how the homiletics task is going to address itself to that kind of diversity, I would not be so bold as to say it. You can hardly sort of, I suppose you could conceivably, give everybody a copy of our questionnaire and then separate them out into and say, okay, we got a church service for you at 9 o'clock and one for you at 10 o'clock. No, that really wouldn't be very good. Right. and I don't want to fall into the trap of categorizing people, individuals, that readily. That's always a danger. But there are these four different types of belief that you're likely to encounter. I expect now I'd like to take the remainder of the time and allow you to respond in terms of what this means to you, how you see it possible to handle the homiletic task, the preaching task, with that kind of diversity.
Just a question here of percentages. Could you put any percentage tags on these four types?
10%. This is very rough again. Very rough. So don't hold me to these, but we know we're all going to get that question. So we do try to figure it out. About 10%, 10 to 12% Ishmael, 20% Solomon type, 35% elder brother, and 30% Abraham. The other two or three would be sort of rounding error. We can't get exact. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you type them, and I know you made that modifying statement right at the end, is this a matter of birth? Is this a matter of environment? Maybe I'm getting off track of a basic subject, but. The reason I asked it is the back of my mind was horoscopes, which so many people can read. You say they type themselves according to horoscopes.
Okay, I respond by saying the fact that we can divide our sample up and find groups of people who show these patterns of belief, and they're very distinct, and that's very real. And in most instances, the differences between them are so whopping that the probabilities that they would occur by chance are like 1 in 1 billion. You know, the computer prints out 9 zeros, and then it stops because it figures anything beyond that, is just no point. That's real. There are people, there's sufficient groups of people who will consistently and regularly respond across 740 items that you get those patterns. The extent to which others in the sample that are not clearly in one of those groups would be more in one direction or another is indeterminate. So we take the top quarter, top and bottom quarter, and it leaves out half. So the middle half is sort of left out in terms of finding the typology. As to what causes those patterns that are real, I think it has to do with belief. Not environment, not heredity, but the level of a person's cognitive belief factors. That's what causes it. As I said, on the Solomon type, where it appears as if age might be a factor, we did run a separate check, and age is independent. It does not interact. The same with the Ishmael type, where it appeared that lower levels of education might be a factor that would account for this. Again, we ran an analysis of that, tested out, and education does not have an effect. It's not a significant effect for the Ishmael group. So we looked at all of those kinds of variables, and they do not appear to have any real significance. What appears to be the operative factor is simply what kind of belief system is there. Yes, sir?
How come that you get people of the Ishmael type to acknowledge church membership at all?
This is the group...
The way you describe doctrinal commitment.
Yeah, this is the group that would be clearly most marginal and most peripheral. But they're still on the rolls, and we made some very serious efforts to get marginal and peripheral people involved in the study and get their responses. Internally, yes, the Ishmael types are going to be not very often in church. They're going to have some hostility toward the church, toward the people in it. They're not going to be contributing much, and all of those kinds of things. They're clearly marginal people, but they're still there. We got them to respond. They came to church, they filled out questionnaires, and that's part of the pattern. Am I responding to your question?
Yes.
Yeah. Because we did make an effort. We also have, and it's in the book, information on those persons who were drawn as part of the sample, but who did not respond. We did a follow-up study on non-respondents. The original sampling frame included almost 6,000 people. We got close to 5,000, 73% response rate. But we also have information that's in one of the appendices on those who didn't respond, and that information would lead me to say that's most likely going to be mostly Ishmael. Yes, ma'am?
Don't you think that some of us grew up in congregations that were highly structured toward producing Ishmaelite type people?
Well, I don't think that the congregation does that as much as does the experience that the promise of the law is not there, and it doesn't work. As I understand how this happened, and this is sort of a projection on my part based on my understanding of the way it works for people, that Ishmael type tends to be elder brother type, who have found out that being faithful does not work. It doesn't pay off. I think that's what happened to, let's say, youth and confirmation
you know, had sort of high hopes about this, maybe even very high levels of commitment, or maybe even at that time some hostility or rebelliousness. Although they do say, they tend to say more than the other groups that they are less religious than their parents. It's more characteristic of the Ishmael type when asked along a whole number of things, how do you compare to your parents? Is this more like your parents? Is it like both you and your parents? Or is it more like you? It's the Ishmael group that tends to more strongly say things like, I am less religious than my parents, particularly the father. So I understand that to mean most likely for many of the people in that group, they are elder brother types or were at one time found somehow trying to live by the law didn't work for them and now have become angry about it. Yes, sir?
If belief determines or shapes in which typology one would fall, is it fair to ask what causes or creates belief, particularly with regard to the question about parentage? Would parentage at all a factor in terms of whether or not one's offspring is going to be the same typology?
We gathered lots of information on relationship to parents, and we made very strenuous efforts to find out how that worked. So that, as I think I mentioned earlier this afternoon, in the automatic interaction detection procedure, we compared 39 and up now up to 60 variables simultaneously at one time. We always included the information about degree of identification with parents, a level of trust with parents, how like the parent the individual perceived himself. None of that worked out. It just didn't have much effect. The only point at which identification with parents proved to be a significant factor was, or would be, in the Abraham type. Those very clearly or highly oriented toward the gospel, where there was a strong positive identification with the parent. So we got the positive side of parental identification. The negative side was not consistent. It did not work out. Which would lead me to say, yes, if there is a good, a close, gospel sort of oriented family life that appears to have some effect in that person's growing up in that, are likely to have a better sense of the gospel. The fact we don't get the negative aspect of parental identification would indicate to me that if you have bad parents, that doesn't necessarily mean you're sort of lost for life. Because that does not relate to any of the consistently negative things otherwise.
Abraham types then, not in all cases, indicated positive identification with parents.
Right.
So many that didn't indicate that?
Yes. It's more characteristic of that group, but it's not exclusively that group. Yes, sir?
I feel I worked with 15, maybe 15 to 55. If you have to do a longitudinal study to find out if being four times a set by age 15 or developed all over the years?
In terms of the typologies, I would respond saying they're not set. People move in and out of them. That would be my judgment. In order to establish that, yes, we would have to do a longitudinal study. The only way in the social sciences that you can get solid causal information is through a longitudinal study. By the way, in the January issue of the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, there is a report of one of the longitudinal studies that was begun in the 30s in California, Berkeley Growth Study, where researchers out there have followed the same group of people since they were born until at the present time they're in their middle 40s, like me, and have periodically gathered information, 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, information both on the child and the parent, consistently. All through the years, a regular pattern of gathering data, both psychometric, observational, that is where trained persons would interview parents, observe what went on in the home, spend the day in the home, watch the patterns, code it all. Now, that's all been piling up since 1931. And we're beginning to get first reports out of this. And in the article that appeared in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical, they attempted to, or they did report what they discovered were the optimal or the antecedents of optimal adjustment in later life. In other words, what kinds of things in early life were positively related to a good adjustment, happy life at age 43? What would you predict? What kind of relationship?
A loving relationship.
The conclusion to which the authors come to is as follows. I think I can quote it. Quite contrary to the heavy emphasis in the literature upon the importance of maternal love and warmth, our data indicates that far more important as an antecedent of optimal mental health are cognitive coping skills on the part of the parent and a moral, philosophical value system, shorthand for religion. Pardon?
What are cognitive coping
skills? Okay, unpack it. All right. They're saying essentially that while there is a low positive relation between the presence or absence of maternal or paternal parental love and warmth, it's not very powerful. But what is more powerful is whether the parents exhibit the ideational, conscious, the cognitive skills to cope with life, with stresses, they can respond to situations that arise in daily life with some degree of rationality, calmness. You know, they don't push the panic button and flip out if Johnny's playmate bites his finger or begins to play with his penis or, you know, something of that sort. But they handle those kinds of situations, job loss on the part of a father. They handle those things calmly, cognitively. They work at it, and they solve those kinds of problems. Together with that there is the presence in the parental life of what they call, what they term a moral value philosophical system. Some system of values, beliefs that integrates and coordinates and sort of puts together all of life so that you can make sense of it. Of course, the article is followed by discussion by three other persons, and two of them are very heavily invested in maintaining that, well, spite of what this longitudinal study says, it's still love. Yes, sir.
Would the work of Herstein against another imply that parents with high IQ would be the ones that would be able to cognitively...
The answer is that, right. Yeah, and that's a little bit disturbing. But it sort of makes sense, I guess, that the more IQ points you got, better off you are to have a little bit happier life.
And therefore, more likely to produce children. I mean, that is a determining factor to whether a child is well adjusted and capable.
Determining is a strong word. Contributing, possibly. May not be a necessary cause, nor it might not even be sufficient, but a contributing cause. But that is true. Yeah, there was a relationship between IQ levels. Again, not strong enough that the Berkeley growth study type saw that as the determining factor. They weren't willing to say that. That's why they coined the phrase cognitive coping skill. But it is true, yeah, IQ has something to do with it. So you've asked about longitudinal studies. You did over there. We're beginning to get reports out of them now. And so far, those reports, again, I think, would support fundamentally the framework that we have in the study. Yes, sir.
Would you be willing to relate to the different groups you talked about tonight to what you said this afternoon as far as there being a crisis impending in the future if we don't somehow relate belief to truth?
The truth claim. Yeah. Yes. The persons where there's going to be the greatest divergence between stated belief claims and the truth claim are the elder brother types. The Ishmael types are not making the belief claim. The Solomon types are not making the belief claim. The Abraham types are making the belief claim, but tend not to have trouble with the truth claim. And those two tend to go together. But where the problem lies, that I spoke of this afternoon in those terms, belief, evidentiary, and truth claim, it lies principally with the elder brother type. And that's why I see it as another thing that makes me see it as a crisis. If I'm correct in formulating that the Ishmael types are elder brother types gone bad, and you get that kind of tension existing within the elder brother types, the most numerous group of these four, that's where it's more likely to go bad. And they could then slip over into the Ishmael typology. Yes, sir?
Do you have any indication of change from one of the other three to Abraham? How does the person become an Abraham?
All I can say is, both in terms of looking at the data as with my training as a psychologist and a theologian, it's much easier to make sense out of and to build formulations for the effect of the law than it is the gospel. Much easier. It's just clearer. It's just there more in the data, and it ties in so readily with lots of other kinds of psychological things, lots of other kinds of theories. Bob and I were talking during the period in between. And it's very clear, many of the items are the same. We've used them from the California FKL, that all the stuff that's been done on authoritarian personality type, and there's 50 years of research on this, is very closely connected with what we're calling a law orientation. You know, you have a tie in there. You got lots of other strands to pull from for this whole law thing. It's much more difficult conceptually and theoretically to deal with the gospel and how that happens. I hope you understand that. That was a harder theological task. Yes, sir. All right, if you put it that way, the reverse flow could occur too. Yes. That you could, this would be what you'd expect if one thinks of a progression, if we want to talk in that language, development, that it could go from Ishmael to elder brother to Abraham. But that could be a progression. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any plans for a lot of similar studies that may have? Back to the original question as to how you deal with this homiletically, and that is, this is part of that was part of my question is to, you know, how does somebody become an Abraham? That in a longitudinal study that you would look at people's experience and see what happens if they quit and change the church.
We don't have any plan for a longitudinal study. Lots of hope. The problem with a longitudinal study is very simply money. It would not be difficult to conceptualize, it wouldn't be difficult to plan, and it wouldn't be terribly difficult to conduct. You know, those are not the problems. The problem is money. You have to get somebody who provides you with, depending on the complexity of it, anywhere from $100,000 to $500,000 a year for, you know, 10 years. That's lots of money. Yes, sir. Generally, what he wants from other people tends to be those who are like him. He wants friendship. And he tends to have lots of friends, tends to say he has friends, lots of friends in his congregation, lots of people who are like him who are friends. Beyond that, he tends to express the wanting to have other people leave him alone.
Seems to me that we think of preaching to this spectrum. You can really drive yourself up the wall as a preacher trying to get ready for a thing like that. or more seriously, the fragile line of language of a courage sermon reaching out over this group of human beings. Gone as I hear you talking, one chance for any